Well, we're here because, we want to talk about Publishers Weekly primarily, I think.
Good. Great.
Before we get into the new books and things, let's talk about Publishers Weekly. Can you give me kind of a historical perspective about how Publishers Weekly was originated, how it all came about?
Yes, I can. I mean, it's quite old. It dates back to 1872, which means we'll do our 120th anniversary issue next year. It began essentially as a sort of collective catalogue for the different publishers. They figured it was a good idea if they pooled their resources and instead of sending out individual ones, do it all at once so that the booksellers could see what was coming up. And that's how the magazine began. I mean, it was called The Publishers Apostrophe Weekly at that point, and basically it was a list of books, and gradually we began to add features and articles, and not until much, much later, I think, in the early 40s did we begin to review books, and of course we now review something like 5,000 a year, and it's probably the single most important part of the magazine in terms of our professional readership. Booksellers, librarians, and so on, they all read our early reviews. These are very early reviews, done generally 2 or 3 months before the book is officially released, to give the booksellers and librarians an idea of what's coming up, to see what they should have on their shelves for their patrons.
Oh, it's very helpful. I look at all of those. Mm-hmm. There are many reviews, actually.
Yeah.
Just a couple of paragraphs. I published a novel in 1988. St. Martin's Press published
right.
the book. And naturally, the first review was going to be either Kirkus or Publishers Weekly.
That's our only rival, is Kirkus, of
That's
course.
Right.
Yep.
And I was afraid, you know, I was
mm-hmm.
because if I get a bad review in Publishers Weekly, it dampens everything.
It does spoil to dampen
everything.
Other reviewers, for instance, look at our reviews to decide what perhaps they might take a look at and what is probably not worth taking a look at. So to that extent, we help guide the other reviewers as well. How was it, in any case, when it came out?
It was a good review, thank
you. I'm glad to hear that. Great,
it was
great.
A very good review. Generally a good review. I can't remember exactly what it said.
There may have been a few nits to be picked.
Yeah, but it was all
sure.
right, and that set the tone. You know, if it's a bad review, it sets the tone. The writer doesn't feel very good about it. The
publisher tends to lose interest.
Yes, precisely.
Yes.
And as it was, the book only sold about 4,000 copies, so it was far and away not a bestseller, but at least I felt kind of good. I was able to cut out the review of Publishers Weekly and put it in my scrapbook.
That's presentable enough for a first novel by a comparative unknown. Really.
Comparative unknown.
Right. Were you encouraged to try again, or you haven't?
Oh, been? I work at it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, let's get back to Publishers Weekly, and you are the editor-in-chief.
Right.
When did you come aboard?
I came aboard in 1973 as managing editor, and stayed there as managing editor for about 5 or 6 years, and then I went off to launch an independent, consumer-oriented magazine called Book Views. That only lasted a couple of years. You may not even remember that. That lasted from 1977 to 79, I guess. And when that folded, fortunately, they welcomed me back aboard, this time as editor, because they'd had an editor in the meantime who I guess hadn't worked out, and they were looking for somebody who was experienced on the magazine and asked me to come back. All was forgiven.
No hard feelings.
Right.
Who is the owner of Publishers Weekly?
It's now owned by a large publishing group called Kanners, which owns about 60 or 70 trade magazines in this country and is in turn part of a vast British conglomerate called Reed. Mm-hmm. Reed Publishing owns a number of British magazines and newspapers and also several major British publishers, including the aptly named Octopus Group, which has many, many different arms.
Well, the Publishers Weekly is certainly the Bible of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other magazine quite like it, is there?
No other magazine quite like it. There's a little newsletter called the BP Report, which sort of, concentrates on the business side of the thing, but they don't do book news or reviews or bestseller lists or features or anything like that. It's simply a limited circulation newsletter. And the American Booksellers Association has something called the American Bookseller, which covers some of our territory in material of interest to booksellers and so on, but nobody covers the entire book beat the way we do now.
It's primarily, however, aimed at the trade. You don't normally find Publishers Weekly on the newsstand, do you?
No, indeed. There was an attempt to put a few copies out, but it really wasn't worth the effort. So now we just do essentially four or five issues a year in a big way, the two announcement issues, spring and fall, and a couple of children's issues. And they get circulated in newsstands, and most of the chain bookstores take a few copies, and they sell those to, I guess, really confirmed book lovers, the kind who just have to know what's coming up next. A casual book lover wouldn't be interested even so.
I would think the professional writer would find it invaluable as well.
He certainly should. We have probably 3,000 or 4,000 writers on our subscription files, I would guess. And I think really any bright writer, particularly in nonfiction, would find it a valuable guide to the kind of books that are being written, about what subjects, what trends are developing, how well they're doing, what books are being signed up, what are being made into movies, what are getting good rights sales, that sort of thing. It's professional information for a writer who takes themselves seriously, I think, as a career writer.
What is the circulation of Publishers Weekly?
38,000, about.
That's very respectable.
It's okay. I'd say its influence is probably out of proportion to its actual circulation. Sometimes a magazine that's well-known like we are has a much lower circulation than you'd think. Variety, for instance, who's probably even better known than we are, particularly in the entertainment business, has a smaller circulation than we do. I think it's about 24,000, 25,000. And yet, you know, it's known around the world.
But publishing in itself is more influential than its size would indicate it.
I think so, sure.
Its very nature, I mean, the very nature of books, the intellectual thrust and influence of books is something that is vastly influential.
I think so.
And that's why publishing is very important, even though it seems to be a relatively small industry.
It is kind of small. At the moment, it's approximately a $15 billion a year industry, which is, you know, barely the size of a month's take for a really large 500 corporation. So it's kind of small. When Jimmy Carter was president and peanuts were much in vogue, it was generally conceded that the publishing business was about the same size as the American peanut industry.
Well, you've been monitoring the publishing industry for a long, long time, John. How's it doing? It seems to me that more and more books are published every year. I was reading this is not the big issue, but the issue of the 23rd about the climate of books in the summer.
The summer bookselling survey, yeah.
And it seemed to be very pessimistic.
Some of it is pessimistic. Actually, the title said sort of hot, cold, and medium, essentially. I mean, some booksellers are doing fine. Others say things are very ho-hum, and still others, particularly in the Northeast, which seems to be the area hardest hit by the recession at the moment, are finding it quite difficult to keep things afloat. All of them, I think, agreed, however, that they're kind of optimistic about the fall season, because there really are some excellent books coming up by a lot of tried and true, proven authors.
Before we go into the fall books, the publishing industry itself, the publishers, several years ago there was a hue and cry that independent publishing was dying, that the conglomerates were a very bad influence on publishing. But I'm not sure that is the case. It seems to me that in many instances they've kept well-known imprints alive, and some of them seem to be doing quite well. For example, Knopf, for example, is an imprint of a giant conglomerate. It's not bad off for that.
No, indeed. They've kept Modern Library alive, and they're bringing back an old classic collection called Everyman's Library shortly, too. So I'm always a bit skeptical of these enormous anti-conglomerate statements. I mean, I don't think conglomerates have that deadening effect, really. Everything really depends on the people working for the companies and the kind of freedom they're given. And by and large, a lot of bright and idealistic and highly intelligent people continue to work in publishing, and provided they don't lose too much money, I think they're given a fair amount of headway.
Publishing is a very low-paid industry, isn't it?
In terms of what the employees get paid, not great. Not great at all. In fact, there was a little survey of the compensation of some of the best-paid publishing executives a few weeks ago. I mean, obviously the only ones we know about are the ones that are publicly traded, which is a comparatively small number of publishing companies. But, you know, you've got a number of chief executives of quite large and important companies. They were making no more than $250,000, $300,000 a year. I think only one of them earned more than $1 million.
Must be Richard Snyder.
Richard Snyder was sort of certainly in there. Right. But lower down, of course, you know, you're getting people with PhDs and excellent degrees who could certainly be making more as doctors or lawyers, earning no more than $25,000-$30,000. Sure.
Must be the love of literature, the feel of books.
It's a sense of being involved in something important and perhaps a little more important than, you know, just the week's paycheck or keeping up the payments on the house. You feel, I guess, at best that you're part of a significant cultural tradition. You're helping keep a country's culture alive. You're helping make the products of some of the most imaginative minds of each generation available to the succeeding generations. That's some sort of recompense, even if it doesn't pay the bills.
Well, I've always wondered how these young college graduates from Sarah Lawrence and so forth manage when they come down to work in publicity departments and make $16,000, right. Well, you can't get an apartment.
There's a lot of apartment sharing goes on, of course, and sometimes there's some help from daddy. I mean, there's a celebrated case told of a young woman of exactly that kind who once went to her boss and said, I'm sorry, I just can't live on the salary you're paying me. And he said, good God, you're not trying to live on it, are you? This notion that somehow this was something you did as a hobby and, you know, more or less for pin money, something in your spare time, as it were. That tradition, I'm afraid, still dies hard.
That's a feeling some editors have for writers, too, that don't expect any money from this book.
Mm-hmm.
This is something you're doing for fun. And most of the writers I know, including an amateur writer such as myself, just work our tails off.
Of course you do.
Do it. Even if it's said, you know, somewhere I read, it's said that it's just as hard to write a bad book as it is a good book, you know. So even if you have a clunker out there, whoever wrote it worked hard on it.
Absolutely. And, I'd say writing a book, good or bad, probably requires more work for less money than almost anything you can do on the face of the earth, including sweeping the streets.
I remember my editor at St. Martin's was Joan Kahn.
Yes, of course, I know Joan.
She's retired now.
Yeah.
And I had written this manuscript in the first person. And she didn't like it in the first person. Asked me if I would do it in the third person. The hero of this book was a middle-aged Jewish bookseller from the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I'm from Wichita, Kansas. So
right.
I mean, she said it was very difficult for me to get into the character role. And she thought it would be better off if I did it in the third person. So I did. I have a computer, and it was fairly easy to do because there were stretches of the manuscript that didn't have to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I hand-delivered the new manuscript to Joan, and I wrote on it, new version, destroy all other copies. Well, the manuscript was sent out for editing. I got it in the mail. I opened it up, and there it was, the first person with one of the first original manuscripts sent out for editing. And I was bouncing off the walls.
I can imagine.
Was furious. They had completely lost my new manuscript, and she was the one who had me redo it. Matter of fact, the book had to be pushed back from spring to fall as a result of this terrible error. And that wasn't the only problem either. The administrative assistant, there was a story in Publishers Weekly that I read. And I know it was Joan Kahn's administrative assistant where a manuscript was sent back to the wrong author for editing.
Wow.
It wasn't even his manuscript.
That's amazing.
And it was in your magazine that I read that, and I said, that's got to be Joan Kahn's administrative assistant. And it turned out that it was.
I guess this person didn't last too long.
No,
we'd like to think not.
No. But I just felt at that time that they were sloughing it off.
Mm-hmm.
There was no excuse to have treated that manuscript as cavalierly as. And I have all the respect in the world for Joan.
Sure.
And I'm sure she relied on her assistant to help her. But I would go into her office and there would be manuscripts up to the ceiling.
That's still true of most editors' offices, I'm afraid.
And yep. she says, there was a good story. I read a good book in here. You know, I'm considering buying it. And she was going through it. She says, I can't. I'm not sure where it is. Come back next week. I'm sure I'll find
right.
it by then. Meanwhile, the author is waiting.
Of course. Sure.
And it's likely that she'll have lost it. And a matter of fact, I have a friend named Paul Jeffers who writes mystery novels, and she edited a couple of his books and indeed lost one of his manuscripts, which she ultimately bought.
Wow. Yeah.
Anyway, that's well off the point. Let's go back to Publishers Weekly and You said that some of the booksellers indicate a certain degree of optimism with regard to this fall when the major books come out. I guess that's the big season.
It's a very important one. In fact, it's generally estimated that about 40% of all book sales are made in about 10 weeks preceding Christmas, when people are either buying for themselves or buying gifts for others, of course.
Well, you mentioned that the tried and true authors are the ones going to be represented this summer, fall for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Can you name them?
Well, of course, Tom Clancy has kind of jumped the gun already. I mean, he's first out of the gate among the big four bestsellers. He's got a new book called The Sum of All Fears, which is on the bestseller list right now. But although he's the first, there are other regulars and not-so-regulars who are toiling along in his wake and all have books coming out in the next couple of months. Frederick Forsyth is going to be back. Ken Follett has a book about a transatlantic flight in the early days of aviation, a Pan Am flight in 1939, if you can imagine such a thing. And Norman Mailer is back with an enormous book called Harlot's Ghost, 1,300 pages, all about the CIA. Fascinating book.
I can hardly wait to read that.
Boy.
You got a good review in Publishers Weekly.
It did, in fact, yeah, right. I agreed with the review entirely because it's, despite its length and despite what I've sometimes thought of as Norman's rather knotty style, this reads very rapidly and smoothly, and it's really a pleasure to read. It's exciting, it's entertaining, it's sometimes funny, and it's a sort of young man coming of age in the agency, as they used to call it. There may even be a sequel, as far as I can make out. Whether or not he's serious about that, I don't know. Another 1,300 pages, perhaps. In any case, it ends with Kennedy's assassination, so he's still got 27, 28 years to go.
Then, of course, there are the Stephen Kings and
mm-hmm.
Daniel Steeles,
of course. I mean, they have something every year, so there's never any danger of their fans having to wait too long for another one. They're kind of amazing, their sheer productivity is quite extraordinary.
Well, I was talking to a young woman who was a desk assistant out in our newsroom, and she was reading a Judith Krantz, and she reads all the Judith Krantz, and more power to her, but I was suggesting to her that she might try some other authors. I gave her a list of excellent, if she likes female authors, there are terrific ones, Joyce Carol Oates, and I mean, on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And I suggested that she try to read some of these better quality books. As long as you have the challenge of reading, you might as well read something that is challenging and somewhat better written than
sure.
Judith Krantz's stuff. Wouldn't you say, I have a feeling that people are so used to reading Judith Krantz and the other popular novelists that they're afraid to take a chance on anything else.
Could be. I mean, people certainly develop a habit for certain authors. I mean, my own assistant has a passion for Jean Owl, you know, the cave bear lady, and she will read everything that Jean writes, but not a great deal else. I mean, this is she waits, you know, patiently or impatiently for the next one to come out and then sinks herself in it happily for weeks. Somehow, certain authors, I guess, have a gift of creating a world that people want to sink themselves into and perhaps not be as much in touch with real thoughts or feelings or contemporary thoughts or feelings as are more commonly dealt with in the better written books, shall we say.
John, I was reading in Publishers Weekly, which I read faithfully every week, of course, that they've actually found a writer for Ivana Trump.
So they have. Yep.
Lucky woman. Now she has someone to write her book for her. Huh?
And this is a Hollywood script writer who's been responsible, as you probably read, for Dynasty and Falcon Crest and all sorts of good stuff. Was early involved with Dallas, so she should be right up to handling Ivana's sort of material, one would think. It'd be interesting to know who does what.
Well, you, of course, being the editor of Publishers Weekly, you have to kind of take a middle-of-the-road position here. But isn't it kind of galling that I think it's Pocket Books, right?
Pocket Books. Right.
Giving, what, $5 million or something, and they have to hire somebody to write her book for her? I mean, that, I don't know, there are so many worthy authors who would be happy to earn a fraction of that in advance, or even no advance, just to get a book published.
I know what you mean. I mean, the argument you'll get back, and you would certainly get it back, were you to be talking to Irwin Applebaum at Pocket Books, was that the sort of success that they hope for from the Ivana book and others like it enables them, in fact, to publish a lot of books that don't make money or barely break even.
Not pocketbooks. No, not pocketbooks.
Not so much. Not so much.
Simon & Schuster does. I mean, Simon & Schuster mm-hmm. does have a, I guess you call it a mid-list.
Yeah.
They do have a mid-list of some fairly high-quality fiction. It's hard to...
So they do. Yeah, nearly all the major companies do, in fact. I mean, even Pocketbooks publishes a few good authors. There's a very good new book called A Boy's Story, I think it is. Excellent. I mean, a good mid-range thriller, and I think that'll be a very good good seller.
Scoot up a little bit.
Sorry.
I just find so many fascinating facts in reading Publishers Weekly. I see that Charlie Sheen's book of poetry... I think I read
that. That may be apocryphal. I mean, it was leaked to us as a proposal, and there were a few poems included in it. Nobody, I think it was the William Morris Agency, which is his agent, nobody would confirm that this was authentic, but since a similar report appeared in New York Magazine, we figured it probably was. In any case, what you have there is a brief excerpt from one of the poems.
Oh, it's a wonderful
poem. I'm not sure you could read it on the air, though.
No, I don't mind. There's a All goat right. in my ass, living mainly on grass. They say the creature was stolen, yet he feeds in my colon.
That's it.
That's real good stuff.
I think it's pretty striking stuff. Absolutely.
Striking,
I think he got a little jealous of Ali Sheedy and her book of poems, maybe. I mean, the Brat Pack crowd sort of bringing out their hidden thoughts in poetry.
Yeah, when I read in New York Magazine that they were trying to decide which publisher should be allowed to publish the book, they phrased it almost like that.
Mm-hmm.
I began to wonder about who would care about anything Charlie Sheen writes.
I don't know. I mean, I guess...
He's not even a good actor, and he has no affect whatsoever. You've seen his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen him in Platoon and the other thing. He's just barely an actor, and I just wondered why anybody would think he would have anything to say that you would want to go out and buy a book to read.
I wonder myself, actually, Don, and in fact, that's something that comes up occasionally that bookstores talk about when they talk about the books that fail, and we sometimes get readers' letters from enthusiastic readers, and they say that most people who are really enthusiastic readers and who buy a lot of books aren't too terribly interested in television stars and movie stars and so on, and there's a great deal too much attention paid to them in terms of, my story and autobiographies. A few of them make it, if you've got a really imaginative person at work, either writing it or possibly the subject, but all too many of them don't. And I think there is too much thinking in the publishing business that if somebody has a large following on television, they're going to have a terrific book. They published a book by Vanna White a year or so ago, which sank without trace, and another book about the Golden Girls, which also sank without trace.
Well, what Charlie Sheen doesn't know is that poetry is not something that you just jot down and pass. I guess Jimmy Stewart could do it, I guess.
Jimmy Stewart can do it, sure.
But really, I'm talking to Jay Perini, who was a fine poet, and his novel, The Last Station, is coming out in paperback, so I read in Publishers
mm-hmm.
Weekly.
Right.
And I was talking to Jay, and he has a long, long education and training in poetry, up through... I don't know if he has a doctorate, but he up through a master's level at the University of Edinburgh, where he studied the form and the authors and wrote and considered and can write in virtually every form. It's not something you just scratch off. It's something that you contemplate and think about. And that's why it strikes me as somewhat cynical that Ali Sheedy and Charlie Sheen can knock out these poems, even though I'm sure that in Ali Sheedy's case, I read her book, or at least I glanced through it, and I know the poems are well meant, but they're not, these are not people educated in the form.
And, exactly.
And if you want, and that's, I think that's important. You know what I'm saying?
I think it's terribly important. I mean, what they're doing is trading on their fame in one medium to try and sneak in the back door in another, in which they have no background, no experience, no training, and... I think often all too little talent.
This was, in a way, the case with Anne Sexton. I've just finished reading this wonderful biography of her. And she had only a high school education. When she started teaching at Boston University and other places, the then faculty was opposed to it because she did not have this academic training.
Mm-hmm.
And while she turns out that she was a very good and gifted teacher, when... questions were raised about the work of, say, Whitman or Byron and academic poets, she couldn't address these topics because she was not trained in it.
Yes, I understand.
So, I mean, this was a difficulty that she had. She was a good poet. I mean, I'm not knocking Sexton at all.
Of course.
And
but
she,
in the case
and,
of a...
And she, just parenthetically, she did put in her dues. I mean, she took poetry workshops, and she studied with Robert Lowell, and she worked very hard to try to catch up. She never did completely, but there again, she lacked this academic training. So when I read poetry now with a renewed respect, because I used to think that, hell, I can be a poet. Mm-hmm. I just knock off a couple of lines about whatever hurts me in the morning. You know, and that's not really poetry.
No, of course not. In the same way, I mean, you could look at the work of a lot of contemporary painters, for instance, and say, well, that's just a couple of shades of red divided diagonally down the middle. I could do that too. Therefore, what makes it worth several thousand, $100,000 and putting on an important gallery's walls? But the artist has come to that way of looking at things by way of a long apprenticeship, studying, learning, and nobody picks somebody up out of a backyard and simply says, you know, give me a couple of reds and we'll put it on a wall and pay you several hundred thousand bucks. Doesn't work that way.
That's why I just couldn't bring myself to interview Ali Sheedy, although she was available for interviews and she was going around doing talk shows and things, mm-hmm. but I just couldn't bring myself to that. I probably would have done Jimmy Stewart, because I'm of age.
Right.
I grew up with Jimmy Stewart movies. I probably would have just out of affection.
Exactly.
Although I understand.
But it would have been out of affection. I mean, the actual poems weren't really much better than Ali's, I don't think.
No, I think they were worse than Jimmy himself said.
They were more banal, really.
Oh,
yeah.
And he said so.
Yeah.
He said he couldn't understand what all the fuss was about. But I didn't take them seriously, but I always took, and I don't take Ali Sheedy particularly seriously mm-hmm. either, but I... She's not bad. I mean, she's a kid. How did you get so interested in books? How did it all start for you?
Well, I've always been a keen reader, but in actual fact, I came to the magazine more as a journalist than as somebody who knew anything specific about book publishing. I've been a newspaper guy in England, where I originally came from, as you may be able to tell by what's left of the accent. I worked for Reuters News Agency for many years, both here and in Fleet Street, and sort of gradually got into magazine work. And like so many other things, it was a matter of contacts. A guy I'd worked with at one of the magazines became editor of Publishers Weekly at the end of the 60s, and he needed a number two and thought of me.
Can we look a little bit beyond the fall season? And maybe since you are obviously a journalist, you've been involved in this field for so long, you probably have some insights about the future of publishing and where it's going to go, and is it going to be healthy? Is it going to have a healthy future?
Is it going to have a healthy future? Goodness, we're always being asked that, of course. And there are so many different sides of publishing. There's the textbook side, of course, which is terribly important and is much more predictable in terms of the money it brings in. I mean, you know roughly how many textbooks you're going to sell by how many people are in school or college any given year. So that's terrific. I mean, you know they have to have certain books and they get adopted by certain states. So that's reliable income. But when you talk about trade publishing, which is what we're mostly talking about today, the fiction, poetry, and general nonfiction, biographies, how-tos, all that sort of stuff, it's all guesswork, really. It's like backing Broadway shows or investing in Hollywood movies. They can be enormous hits or dismal flops or somewhere in between that's neither one thing or the other. It's not true, by the way, what you said a few minutes ago, that there were more books published each year. That was true until 2 or 3 years ago, but finally they have begun to flatten out, and according to our figures, this year will show the first decline in the number of titles published in the States since I've been in the business in a couple of decades anyway. So it looks as if finally publishers are beginning to take advice that they're always doling out to their colleagues but seldom taking themselves, which is do fewer books and do them better. So I think we'll see a publishing future with perhaps fewer titles and more carefully chosen ones, and I'd like to think better marketed and promoted ones. Publishers are still pretty much in the dark ages when it comes to marketing and promotion, as you may have observed. You know, their notion is to take one ad and see if they can get somebody on a talk show somewhere, and that's it, and then move on to the next. There's very little attempt to reach what might be a considerable constituency for a book, a considerable sized audience or readership, to go out through specialized market areas, to do special sales in offbeat outlets outside of the bookstores. A certain amount of that is done, but not, I think, nearly enough, not as much as could be done.
Well, when you think about it, publishing is an archaic industry. It's so old-fashioned, an old-fashioned way of communicating. You have to physically write a book and have to physically edit it, and you have to bind it and print it and bind it and then ship it out by trucks. And when you think about it, that's pretty old-fashioned.
It is kind of amazing, isn't it? I mean, your average book takes about the same length of time that a human baby is in gestation, about 9 months, between the time the publisher gets the manuscript and the time the bound book hits the store. That is an awful long time, which is why, of course, when publishers want to get out books with a little more urgency, as, for instance, recently on the Desert War, and no doubt around the corner on the recent failed Russian coup, they try and emulate their newspaper and magazine brethren and really dash things around the clock and get out what they call instant books. An instant book for a publisher is something that gets out in maybe under a month or 6 weeks. That's regarded as pretty hot stuff. And everybody knocks themselves out, costs a lot of money to do it, have to keep everybody on overtime, keep the printer standing by, all that sort of stuff.
Publishers could do people like myself a favor, because I obviously get a lot of books, and I save a lot of them, and they take up so much space. I had to rent a warehouse room in Upper Manhattan for my books. But they could print books smaller. I mean, Putnam is notorious about this, particularly. They use thicker paper and big. Some of them, their mysteries are really 200-page books that look like they're 300 or 400.
They are a little padded out. In fact, somebody did a guest editorial for us a while back. You probably saw it if you're a regular reader, complaining of exactly this thing, that in order to bulk the book out to so that it looks as if it's worth over $20, they make the paper thicker, they make the margins wider, they have a blank page between chapters, all sorts of things. Every now and again they'll go the other way, and there's been a deliberate attempt, I think, to make the mailer book, for instance, look a little less than 1,300 pages, because they're afraid it'll scare people. There was also a fascinating book by a brilliant writer called Richard Powers that Morrow published recently. It's a difficult book, and it's a long book, and it's highly intelligent, and it'll be, I'm sure, widely admired by, I'm afraid, a comparatively limited readership, but they didn't want to scare people off and think, my God, there's going to be 700 or 800 pages of this stuff, so they deliberately printed it on somewhat thinner paper with somewhat narrower margins than usual, so that it wouldn't look intimidatingly large.
I think I read someplace that in France the publishers only publish in paperback and no hardcover books. Is that true?
That's pretty much true, certainly in France and in, I think, Spain, and to a lesser extent in Italy. England is much like us, and so is Germany, but France certainly publishes largely in paperback, and in the first editions they often don't have any cover art at all. Your typical French book looks like what we'd think of as a bound galley. It's sort of, plain coloured paper with the title and the author's name printed chastely on the front, and that's it.
Of course, we're doing more of that, aren't we? The trade paperbacks, for example, seem to replicate what they're doing in France.
Yep, to a certain extent, except that once again ours are they're more oriented towards being sold. I mean, there's much more of an effort made in terms of the covers and the typefaces and so on. So there's always the feeling in the American marketplace that you're up against hundreds of other similar products, and the same thing is true in the bookstore, of course. An average bookstore contains 10,000 titles, and yours have got to stand out one way or another. So if you've got a striking cover or a type that hits you from across the room, then sometimes people go as far as to print the same book in several different colored bindings to attract attention that way. That's been done several times, notably, I think, with Alvin Toffler's Future Shock. That was printed in half a dozen different colors, maybe so that people would think each one was a different volume or something. I don't know. In any case, it worked.
I've been reading in Publishers Weekly about these super stores, super books. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any of those?
Yes, I've seen a couple of them.
Why are they different only because of the volume of titles?
That's essentially the difference. It's the depth and and range of the stock that is significant. As I say, your average store, particularly one of the chain stores in a mall, has maybe 10,000 to 15,000 titles, whereas your mega store will have three or four times as many. And an interesting thing is going to happen this fall. America is to be invaded from the other side of the Atlantic by the Waterstones, a British chain that has become very successful in a very short time. I think they're only 8 or 9 years old, by having architecturally elegant stores with extraordinary range of stock, bigger than anything except maybe two or three bookstores in the entire United States. They have 75,000 to 100,000 different titles, which is really extraordinary. And the other thing that they have scored with is having extremely knowledgeable staff. These are people who are trained, who know a great deal about books, who are keen readers themselves. All too often, the people manning American bookstores, particularly the chain stores, of course, are not much more advanced than the sort of people that might make your hamburgers and McDonald's. They'll sit at the cash register and take your money, but if you ask them for any help, or is there something else by the same author, they'll say, well, the section's over there, go and look. So Waterstones has this notion of depth of stock and knowledgeability of service. They're opening in Boston this October and in Philadelphia a couple of months later with enormous stores, and everybody's waiting to see what's going to happen.
We don't have anything like that in Manhattan, do we?
Not really. Considering the size and importance of New York as a bookselling city, the actual stores here aren't really overwhelmingly terrific in terms of depth of stock. Some of them very nice looking, like the old Scribner's store on Fifth Avenue, of course, beautiful looking store. But the range and depth of stock isn't as striking as that in a number of notable bookstores outside New York, like Borders in Ann Arbor or the Tattered Cover in Denver. I mean, these are stores famous for their range and depth of stock. New York has nothing quite on that scale, I have to admit. They have some highly idiosyncratic stores and a lot of special interest stores and some nicely run stores and stores with knowledgeable folks. But in terms of I was in London last spring, and in terms of half a dozen stores I could think of in London owned by Waterstones or Dillon's, another major chain, Hatchard's, there's nothing really to compare with those in New York, no.
Is it a space problem?
It may be partly a space problem, I guess. New York real estate is prohibitively expensive. The kinds of premises where you can expand this way don't come up very often, and then the sort of return from a bookselling operation wouldn't be enough to pay the freight on them, probably. But, you know, London real estate is expensive as well, and somehow they manage there.
I wonder where all the used books go. Remember on Fourth Avenue, even when I first came to New York, which was almost 25
yeah.
years ago, there were probably a dozen stores still left, and they were dying out, of course.
Yep.
And there are probably not more than a dozen or so used bookstores in all of Manhattan now. Just wonder where the used books go.
I don't know. There are some chains around the country. There's something called Half Price Books, which does a large number of used books. Some of the upfront bookstores, I mean front list bookstore, new bookstores, have large used departments. And then there are these sort of swap stores, Annie's Bookstop and so forth, usually in small malls where people bring in used paperbacks and swap them for others. And, you know, they'll sell off the swapped ones for maybe a buck a copy, that sort of thing. But the kind of stores that you used to have on 4th Avenue and Lower Broadway are increasingly few and far between. There are a couple on 18th Street here in New York, the Academy and a fairly new one called Skyline. They both have quite a nice stock, and they've both been started in the last decade, which is kind of encouraging. They were starting up as some of the others were dying out.
There again, I guess the cost of real estate.
Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem. The Academy, I know, wants to expand because it's got half of its books in the basement, and they've been, you know, looking for a neighboring building that they could afford to expand into.
Too bad about Carlos Mendoza down in Lower Manhattan. Remember that story?
Yeah, sure I do.
It's gone, I think. Yep. It's gutted, the building.
Yes, I used to hang around a whole lot of those old used bookstores. I mean, there's only, really, out of all the ones that used to be in that area, there's only the Strand left now.
Well, the Pageant is still there.
Pageant is still there, but I think that gets by on selling prints and things as much as books.
Yeah, yeah. It's not. It's the quality of their books is not very good. Because I love books, and I love. I don't mind secondhand books, but I like the quality to be of. I might like a decent dust jacket on it. I don't
sure.
know. buy. A lot of the books that I have collected over the years I got at secondhand bookstores, and they're first edition books like Steinbeck's and Cheever's and Capote's that are worth a lot of money.
Of course, these are all collectible authors you're talking about.
That's true.
It's funny how some authors are collectible and others aren't, but all the ones you've named are. John Updike is very collectible. Cheever is particularly collectible. Yeah,
I noticed that Publishers Weekly gave a good review of the Journal of Journals.
Yeah. The Journals are extraordinary. The New Yorker has just been running some excerpts, as you've probably seen. Quite amazing. I mean, he had an extraordinary mind and a way of looking at life. These journals are extremely frank about his problems with his wife and his alcoholism and his growing awareness that he was bisexual. And it's fascinating reading because you can see the roots of so many of the kinds of incidents and encounters with people that became his stories. Wonderful stories in my mind.
I think I read in the Times the other day that publishing parties seem to be on the way out. You have gone to so many in your career. Is that the case?
They haven't disappeared entirely. They're done on a far more selective basis than they used to be. I think there was a big one last night for Dominic Dunn, for instance, which was thrown partly by Tina Brown at Vanity Fair in cooperation with his publisher. So you still get some of those. There was a very unusual party the other week for a new novel called Topless, which I gather is going to be a movie, as you might expect, about a priest who inherits a topless bar and the complications that ensue. They had that, in fact, in a topless bar, and you can see the...
I almost went to that.
You did? Well, it was quite a fun party, I gather. You forced yourself not to.
Right. Did you go?
No, I wasn't there, but we had a couple of people there, and we even took some photographs. And,
oh, really?
We took some quite interesting photographs, but...
It
was interesting to note, well, I mean, there were some attractive ladies there dancing on the bar, as you can imagine. But it was interesting to note that the senior executives of the publishing house, who shall be unnamed, took great care not to be in camera range in the same frame as the ladies. And in fact, one of them sort of darted through and pretended he was there when in fact he walked in the front door and out the back so that he shouldn't be seen hanging around too long so that stories would spread.
Well, John, I certainly enjoyed having you here. There's nothing I would rather talk about than books and computers.
Yeah, that makes two of us. Computers too, huh?
And, oh, I love computers, but I think books have the edge. And so I love talking about books and thinking about them, and I like to carry them, and I like to read them. I carry them all over. You know,
so do I. I've got one here. You'll notice that I was...
Yeah, what is that?
That's a new novel by an English writer called Angela Carter. Very, very good writer. Fascinating book. It's about a couple of twin sisters who were big hits on the English music halls in the early years of the century. And it's written in a wonderful, hearty, ribald voice of one of these girls and describing all these theatrical greats and life backstage in England and so forth. It's a wonderful, funny, touching book. Love it.
Oh, I'll have to look for that.
Yeah.
Well, it was great having you here. I appreciate that you took the time out to talk to me, and I'll look forward to editing this tape, and I'm going to try to get it on. My broadcast is syndicated, and I usually have about a two, sometimes a three-week gap. I'm going to expedite this so that I get it in time for the fall books.
That's the spirit. They'll start coming out next month, as you know.
Thank you very much, John.
Thanks, Don.